It's the First Time podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us
and conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures. This interview is with Cecilia Rabess. Cecilia is an American author. Her debut novel is Everything's Fine. It's an incredible book, a kind of opposites attract rom-com in some ways, so eminently readable, but it also has a really depthful exploration of politics and race. One of the interesting things about Cecilia's debut experience is that she was at the heart of a book talk controversy before her book came out. As she says, it's not exactly the sort of thing you have on your bucket list, but I think you'll find it really interesting to hear her talk about. Her take on it is not exactly what I would have expected, and it's definitely stuck with me. Other things about Celia is she has previously worked as a data scientist at Google and as an associate at Goldman Sachs. Her nonfiction has been featured in McSweeney's. We talk a little bit about this. Definitely worth checking out her work there, and I will link in show notes. Plus a few other places, 538, Fast Company, Flowing Data, and others.
Welcome, Cecilia, to the First Time podcast.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. Really pleased to be here.
We are going to talk about Everything's Fine and your writing career now, but if we go back in time to the beginning, when did you start writing? Has it always been a part of your life?
Yeah, I think, you know, since I could write, writing has been a part of my life. I think novel writing is sort of new, but I've always loved to read. I feel like this is probably deja vu if you've talked to any other authors in the past, but I've always loved to read. And so writing is sort of an extension of that love. And I think the first real writing I ever did was at the suggestion of my mother. We were on a family vacation and I was like, oh, I'm having so much fun. Like, I wish we could just do this every day. And she was like, well, why don't you commemorate the holiday by writing something about it? So I started a little diary and I actually still have that entry from when I was like 6 years old. It was like, oh, we're on the beach and we saw a coconut tree. So, I mean, it worked, you know, to sort of remember and memorialize an important moment in my life that I think otherwise I probably actually wouldn't have remembered. So that's kind of how it all began, sort of diaristic. And then as I got older and I thought about how am I going to continue to write, I think the only kind of professional writer that I thought existed, even though I had been reading novels my whole life, was a journalist or someone who wrote for newspapers or magazines. So I tried my hand at that a little bit, but I think in the end, you know, like I said, I love to read novels. And so I ended up wanting to write a novel, and that's how I ended up here.
What kind of things did you read growing up?
I think I loved Judy Blume. And so she's been in the zeitgeist for a long time, but just any and everything she wrote. And then Jerry Spinelli was another favorite of mine, but I would really read anything you put in front of me. And I remember spending a lot of time with my mother at the local library. And it's funny because there was a librarian who was extremely friendly and extremely doting, but she could never remember who I was. So she'd always be like, oh, you came in last week and you checked out all those Narnia books. Like, here are some recommendations. And I was like, no, that wasn't me, but oh, like, that's God. So loving and supportive. Yeah, she's just kind of like scatterbrained, but lovely person. And I think, you know, introduced me to probably some books I wouldn't have read otherwise because, you know, they weren't necessarily in my, so that I credit her with a lot of my early reading experiences.
Oh, librarians, they're just the best. Cecilia, do you remember the first thing you had published?
So I think it was an op-ed in my high school newspaper. And I remember it being kind of like a manifesto about how we should rename school president to food liaison to the faculty, because I thought that there was a lot of people running for president because they thought it looked good on their resume, would help them get into university. And I was like, why don't we strip away all the artifice and just call it what it is? Like the classmate who wants to give us better access to snacks, because I felt like that was really what they got done. That was like all they really had leeway to do. And I remember thinking this was like so incisive and so incendiary and everyone just kind of rolling their eyes. But it was, I think, you know, the feeling is not dissimilar to the feeling of publishing a novel. You kind of have a lot to say, and it's really exciting when people listen, and even more exciting when what you're saying resonates, even if it's just with a few other people who really feel the same way about the school presidency.
That is awesome. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if that concept ever does end up taking off.
I don't think it has yet.
If we come back to the present, your debut novel, Everything's Fine, came out this year. Where did the initial seed of the idea for the book come from?
Yeah, so I think, you know, if I think about when I started writing a novel, or when I sort of sat down and said, I want to write a novel, I only really had one kind of rough idea of what it might look like. And actually it was a love story I wanted to write. So I'd always loved good love story. But even the best ones I felt can often exist in this binary where it's sort of like bubblegum rom-com on the one hand and war-torn lovers and somebody dies at the end on the other. And I thought it would be really exciting to kind of situate a sort of more nuanced or more contemporary story in that space in between. So write something that was kind of real, could be sad, could be funny, but just kind of like more reflective of reality. So I had this idea, but, you know, I was staring at a blank page and wasn't sure exactly how to make it manifest. And it was 2018, so it was right in the middle of Donald Trump's presidency. It was kind of a really wild time in terms of the national rhetoric. So I, like a lot of Americans and probably even globally, was asking myself questions about how had we gotten here? Like, what was America? What had we become? Were we always that? Like, just kind of reckoning with it all. And so I had these sort of very mundane questions of a debut novelist, like, what should I write? And what should it look like? And then these much more existential questions about, you know, what is even America? So I was sitting with those two questions, not necessarily thinking that there was any relationship between the two. And then I stumbled upon this article in New York Magazine that was called Donald Trump is Destroying My Marriage, which I feel like I owe this writer a real a debt of gratitude, because I mentioned this article many, many times. And obviously it was sort of the spark of inspiration for the book, because it was about these couples who were opposites politically, who had maybe gotten by, you know, Obama was in America when, you know, the rhetoric was about hope and unity, and we're now like really struggling to hold, was much more fraught. Saying like, that is tension. I'm looking for attention. I'm looking for a plot, characters and setting. And so that article sort of allowed me to find my way into the story. And it allowed me to, like I said, write this kind of more nuanced, contemporary, like reflecting our very fraught reality in the context of a love story, a very fraught one, but a love story nevertheless. So that is kind of the origin. What should it look like? And then these much more existential questions about, you know, what is even America? So I was sitting with those two questions, not necessarily thinking that there was any relationship between the two. And then I stumbled upon this article in New York Magazine that was called Donald Trump is Destroying My Marriage, which I feel like I owe this writer a real a debt of gratitude, because I mentioned this article many, many times. And obviously it was sort of the spark of inspiration for the book, because it was about these couples who were opposites politically, who had maybe gotten by, you know, Obama was in America when, you know, the rhetoric was about hope and unity, and we're now like really struggling to hold, was much more fraught. Saying like, that is tension. I'm looking for attention. I'm looking for a plot, characters and setting. And so that article sort of allowed me to find my way into the story. And it allowed me to, like I said, write this kind of more nuanced, contemporary, like reflecting our very fraught reality in the context of a love story, a very fraught one, but a love story nevertheless. So that is kind of the origin story of Everything's Fine.
So the main two characters in the book are Jess, who is a young Black woman. She has a fairly liberal worldview. Then there's Josh, who's a young white guy with a very conservative worldview. I actually tried to think of examples of this idea of people with very different political worldviews. And it's interesting to hear where the concept came from because I could barely think of any.
The funny thing is the one comp I did hear was The Way We Were, which is from, I don't know, the 60s or 70s. So like a 50-year-old film. I don't know if you're familiar with it. Barbara Streisand and Robert Redford. And sort of a similar conceit, you know, like he's sort of just like conservative, doesn't really think too hard about the world or his place in it politically, very kind of privileged. And then Barbara Streisand is sort of this firebrand. She's always protesting. She's real progressive. And they, you know, against all odds kind of come together and then, you know, come apart without spoiling it. But it's funny because, yeah, that's the only comp, I think, in terms of like these opposites politically that anyone mentioned to me. And, you know, if you know anything about like contemporary publishing, it's like you got to have a comp that's like 2 years old, 3 years old, not like 50 years old. So I think you're right. That's my long-winded way of saying, yeah, I don't know that that's a common conception for a story.
Not at all. I think the other one I thought of was Curtis Sittenfeld's book, The American Wife, is maybe potentially, but a bit different. It's very much the story that you have written is a real opposites attract love story. We can pretty straightforwardly see why Jess and Josh would not like each other. How did you go about making it plausible that they would attract at some point and that they would fall for each other?
Yeah, well, thank you for suggesting that it's plausible pairing. I think that was tricky, of course, because I think, you know, even 10 years ago or 15 years ago, which is part of what the novel's interested in, it wasn't so unusual for, you know, let's say a Democrat and a Republican to be friends or even lovers. But now I feel like you almost like stamp your political party on your forehead and there's sort of like this extreme polarization and we all sort of sit in our echo chambers and there's not as much overlap, I'd say, socially between the two parties. So yeah, the question was, how are they going to get together and how am I going to make it seem realistic? So I think that's part of why one, the characters are quite young. So I think when you're young, you're often thrown together with people who you might not choose to spend time with. And as you get older, maybe your social circles become narrower. So they're, you know, in their early 20s and they're meeting a lot of people and they're doing a lot of things and trying to figure it out. Also, the book is set in the workplace. And I think at work, you are often asked to spend a lot of time very closely with people who you would perhaps prefer not to. So that's kind of how I got them together. And then the question is, okay, how do you actually make them fit or build some kind of compelling relationship between the two? And I think for that, I sort of had to take a step back from their political identities and just think of them as, you know, a boy and a girl. And this goes just like sort of a tangent, but to my love of all things love story rom-com. But I often thought of that line from Notting Hill, very different film. But, you know, when Julia Roberts says to Hugh Grant, "I'm just a girl standing in front of a boy, asking him to love her." I think, you know, at the end of the day, when you strip away all the artifice, they are just two people who do have some things in common. They share a lot of the same interests. They have a sort of similar sense of humor. Even sort of similar backgrounds in that they both grew up without, she grew up without a father, without a mother, he grew up without a father, like in a very important role model that they're both sort of, I think, trying to compensate for. They had all that in common, but there was just all these kind of external forces telling them who they were and why they shouldn't be together. And I think that, you know, is what I was trying to explore. Like, who are we when, you know, we don't necessarily listen to who other people say we are? And not that other people are wrong, but there can be a lot of, you know, people imposing their values or putting us in boxes. And so I thought it was interesting to think about, you know, these two people are very much products of their products of their circumstance. But without those circumstances, you know, who might be? And I think they might be two people who connect very deeply. I think they do, but then there's all of this like complicated baggage that they're carrying.
It's, you have this challenge of both making it plausible that they will like each other, but you also have to create characters that the audience are going to root for too, which I think is a bit of a challenge. Likeability is something that's often discussed in relation to female characters. You've said elsewhere that you had to work a lot harder to make Josh likable. I think the term you actually used was humanize. What did you see as his most unlikable trait?
Okay, this sort of feels like a trick question because I think a lot of people who come to the book would hope or maybe expect that I would say, oh, well, his politics are what make him unlikable. You know, he sort of has some, I think, and I think a lot of people might agree, like some problematic takes. But actually, I think for me, what made him a little challenging is just that he is hard to penetrate. Like, I think, not that he's not listening, but I think he just has this self-assuredness and a sort of the privilege to sort of take a step back from a lot of the issues that he and Jess are grappling with and assess it very coolly, where she is coming to a lot of these issues with a lot more of a personal stake in them. You know, if you think about like how the political is personal, I think some people, like, the ultimate privilege is if it's not personal. And I think for him, that's often the case. And so it's hard to get through to him. And I think that is sort of like his fatal flaw in many ways. And in that sense, he's not necessarily someone who's incapable of change, but I think he's not necessarily changing in the ways that Jess hopes he would or could, or that readers hope he would or could, which I think can maybe give him an unlikable aura. I also think he's a bit of a know-it-all.
It feels like an easy out could have been to have one party convince the other to see things correctly. But it sounds like that is an impulse that, if you had that impulse, was something that you were never going to pursue. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. I think I definitely explored different endings, not only the ending, but I explored different ways to tell the story, you know, happier endings, less happy endings, ambiguous endings, less ambiguous endings. But always they were still sort of at odds throughout the book and by the end of the book. And I think it's because, I don't know, their differences seem a bit irreconcilable to me, you know? And I think the question of the book was less about like, okay, how do we resolve their differences? And more, how and to what extent will they set those differences aside or look the other way or turn the other cheek, however you want to say it, you know, even when it gets really hard or even when it starts to cost quite a lot. And so that's what I was interested in, sort of the compromises we make and why and how and when and what are the consequences. But yeah, I think trying to figure out a way to like make them be in the middle didn't feel plausible to your earlier question, just because, again, like Josh is not really going to give. And I think Jess, because she is, you know, more invested, let's say, personally in, or the stakes are higher for her in terms of the politics of the day, like it wouldn't make sense either for her to necessarily, I don't know, just forget about it all, even though she does compromise in a lot of important ways, in a lot of difficult ways. But yeah, ultimately didn't feel like there was actually middle ground.
which makes the book feel true to life, I think.
Yeah.
It feels like a far more accurate reflection of relationships. Race is central to this book. As a reader, reading it myself, it felt like a real education in microaggressions, and in particular how unrelenting and draining they can be. Did you consciously think about what experience you wanted the reader to have?
You know what? I have to admit, I didn't. I think, or at least not initially. So two things. When I started writing, and in general, when I write anything, it's definitely as an expression of myself. And I'm sort of, I see myself as an artist, and I'm just creating from, you know, a deep well of like experience and emotion and interest. So I'm just sort of doing my thing. And so therefore not really thinking about anyone but myself and sort of the questions that are pressing on me. That said, of course, I've sold this book and I wanted to publish it and wanted people to read it. So there is a point at which the reader does become interesting to me. But that was after I sort of drafted the book and figured out what it was going to be and what I was trying to do. And then when sort of I start to have conversations with my agent and editor about, you know, how to make the book more readable or more exciting, I think my North Star is always just what's going to get the reader turning pages more than anything. Like, they can love it, they can hate it, it can make them laugh, it can make them cry, but I just want them to keep going. And so I think that was the only way in which I concerned myself with the reader, which is an education. I don't know if it's going to be like that for my next book, because, you know, I think readers have certainly met the book in a lot of different ways, but in some ways I certainly did not anticipate. And perhaps that's because I wasn't really thinking about the reader as I wrote. So the reason I write, it's just to kind of work things out for myself. So that's sort of the diaristic tendency, I think, that my mom instilled in me when I first started writing. So with this book, I had a lot of questions. There weren't always answers or easy answers. And so I was sort of writing towards clarity in as much as it was available. But yeah, it was more for me to sort of sit with some of the things, ideas, questions, concerns that were weighing on me.
Yeah. Cecile, you've spoken about where the initial seed of an idea for the book came from. Once you had that idea and had begun to write, what did the writing look like?
I think that my writing process is fairly chaotic, but as I practice more, I'm trying to impose some order. But I think if I had to sort of break it down, the first thing I do is just kind of collect ideas, and they're usually just fragments, and jot them down in usually my notes app. So in this case, it would be things like they fight about Kanye West, or there's a scene at a dinner party, or Occam's razor, just any kind of thought that pops into my head that feels relevant. So I just have like this giant sort of document full of ideas. And from those ideas, then I tried to sort of imagine scenes. So I was like, okay, what about a dinner party? Like, what would be interesting, or what might I want to say or see at a dinner party? And then sort of like I play the scenes out in my head, usually when I'm like lying in bed at night. And then once I kind of like see the scene unfold, I just kind of jot bullet points around like what happens like in the beginning, sort of the beats, I guess. Like he walks in, like he says this, she says that. At that point, I then sit down to write the scene. So by the time I write the scene, I've already spent a lot of time thinking about it and conceptualizing it and seeing it kind of play in like the movie theater of my head. And then I write the scenes. And in this case, for this novel, it being my first, I'm hoping it doesn't happen like this in the future. I wrote all the scenes, but without really any connective tissue between them. They were just all the things I imagined happening to these people. And it was almost like memory, you know, like when, at least for me, when I imagine my life, it's like a bunch of things happening, but there's not any like necessarily like narrative connecting them. So at that point, I tried to create an arc and really think about like what is propelling the story? What is like the central tension? Like what is like moving us from one scene to the other? Which I guess that's kind of late in the process for that to happen after I'd written like 100,000 words. I was like, okay, what is actually the story? Mm. And then once I had that, I sort of went back and tried to like fix the prose, tighten the dialogue, then draw out some themes, like plant some clues or Easter eggs or subtext. And then I can't remember who said this, but one piece of advice that I take very seriously is someone once said that you have to like ring out. You can't see me on the podcast, but I'm like making this ringing out, like you're ringing out a cloth motion. And you basically ring out your prose. And basically that's kind of, I think, a synonym for cleaning it up and tightening it and making sure that there aren't any stray words or thoughts so that it's as clean as possible. Easier said than done, but that's always my intent. And then at that point, you have a novel. And I feel like that makes it sound like an easy, it's like a 7-step process. But it took me years, you know, obviously, of like iterating and getting it wrong in a lot of ways and false starts and stops. But I think that's basically, yeah, the process in a nutshell.
That's a great description of process. I have never heard someone have a process like that or describe it in that way. But I love that idea of starting with those images or fragments and kind of building them up. Mm-hmm. So once you had a finished manuscript, you mentioned an agent before. How did you go about finding that agent?
Yeah, I did it in sort of the way that they, like air quotes, tell you to do it. I just emailed, well, before I even emailed agents, I sort of thought about what books I wanted my book to be in conversation with, what kind of writer I wanted to be, what kind of writer I thought I was. And then sort of collated a list of first, I guess, books and then authors and then agents who I thought fit the bill. A very long list. And then I think the advice is often, you know, reach out to them in batches. So, you know, you query, you write your sort of intro letter. I did a lot of, you could call it research, you could call it stalking, but like for every agent that I reached out to, I tried to personalize the query quite significantly. I don't know if it's necessary, honestly, but I would do a lot of due diligence and make sure that if there was any way I could connect to them personally, I did.
Oh, so did you reach out?
Well, like, yeah,
drop into people's DMs and
no, not okay. Reach out personally, like in that sense, but more like if they had stray tweet that was like, my dog Fido likes bones, I'd be like, yeah. Your dog Fido likes bones. Like, that's amazing. You know, something like that. But I mean, I tried a little harder than that, but I went a little bit deeper than maybe is normal. And so I then had a long list of agents and started reaching out to them. But again, I was a little bit extra about this because the first group of agents I reached out to, I made sure that on their manuscript wish list or in whatever way they seemed to express what they were interested in, it was like exactly aligned to what I thought I'd written. So I was like, if this is executed well, there's no way these agents will not like this book. So it felt to me like a good way to kind of assess whether it was sort of the pages or the concept / query that wasn't working. I don't know if that's science, but it felt like it was. So reach out to these, I think like three agents where I was like, this is literally what you want. And a couple of them actually reached out. So I was like, I was correct. This is what you want. And then they read the manuscript, but it was actually in pretty bad shape. I have to admit, because unlike the advice that people give, which is like, you know, when you finish your draft, you have to sit with your draft, you have to revise your draft, you have to get feedback on your draft, et cetera. As soon as I typed the end, I was like, all right, I'm sending those emails, which is like, not great, but I was just like really
ready,
excited. Yeah. So I got some feedback, but the manuscript was in kind of bad shape. So it wasn't even that useful because it was like not even where I wanted the story to be. So then people were giving feedback on things that I was like, oh, well, I was going to delete that anyway. So then I, you know, revised again, sort of did the same exercise again with more agents. Funnily enough, this is just my luck. One of the agents that I reached out to, who's like a very big name, like super successful agent, and had no interest in the book or representing me, but for whatever reason was like, I'll read the manuscript and give you some feedback just to kind of be a good literary citizen. So wow. She did this and she gave me feedback. Yeah, it was very kind of her. But it was funny because she did it in such a way that it was clear. She was like not interested in this book. She was just being a nice person. And so that I think helped me take myself seriously. So even though I was getting only rejection at that point, I was like, okay, well, she's a real person. She's a pro. She's willing to read it. So it can't just be garbage, even though she doesn't want to represent it. I kind of ignored that part. And so that was then, I think, the final push that I needed to like, okay, buckle down, like really revise this, like do the thing they actually said, where I like get it in to a place where I feel like it's actually great. Because before I was like, oh, this has potential, doesn't it? So then at that point, I did my final round of querying for agents. And that is when I met my current agent. And another funny thing is that I didn't meet her. I didn't actually query her. I queried someone else at her agency who said, oh, this is not for me, but it might be for my agent. And it was. And that was, I thought, a fantastic end to the story, because that's another thing that I was like, that would never happen. If I wasn't interested, I'd just tell you to go kick rocks. But indeed, it does happen. And so I've been with my agent since we sold the book. She's fantastic. Extremely happy ending. I think pretty like typical road. Like it wasn't extremely difficult, but it wasn't extremely easy. So I feel fortunate the way it worked out.
It's nice also just hearing and acknowledging instances of good literary citizenship, like people going a bit out of their way.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Everything's Fine came out in June, but prior to publication, before anyone had actually read the book, people on TikTok and Goodreads had certain things to say. How did you learn that something had gone awry and what happened?
Yeah, we'll talk about good literary citizenship. I think I woke up, but I can't remember if it was like in the morning or not, but a friend, another writer friend, texted me and she said, your book is doing some numbers on Twitter. And I was like, what does that mean? Like, I wasn't even very online at that point. I think I am now. But like even the syntax was confusing to me. I was like, doing numbers? What does that mean on Twitter? Like, my book isn't even out. So I then followed the link that she shared. And I saw that someone had basically suggested that my book, based on the synopsis on the back cover, was, I don't know, kind of like white supremacist apologia, fetishistic, like racism oppressor, oppressed. Like
it was a
fan fiction.
Having read the book, it was like, oh, okay, yeah.
There was a lot in there, but yeah, I guess the TLDR is that the book was racist, and then subsequently, I as the author was racist, and therefore must be held to task. So that was, yeah, like I said, not something I had on my 2023 pre-publication bingo card. So it was quite surprising. And in particular, even though I think the book, you know, is a bit of a Rorschach test and, you know, you can read it in different ways, I don't think it necessarily picks a side, at least not too aggressively. But the protagonist is sort of this liberal Black woman. So I didn't expect, if there were to be pushback, that it would be from people who were aligned to the Black liberal woman perspective. But in fact, it was. So that was a real twist, you know?
You think it helped in terms of how you felt at the time that people had not read the book, or did that make it harder?
I think it helped because naively at the time, I think I was like, oh, it's fine. All they'll do is read it. And, you know, this will all be water under the bridge. It's just a big misunderstanding. But of course, that's not really how it works. You know, I think a lot of people, you know, we're just looking for someone to go after. I think I was somewhat of an easy target, ironically, because, you know, this is sort of a campaign in the name of anti-racism that was, to me, quite racist, because I'm a Black woman, and I think people hold Black women to different standards sometimes than white women or white men. This character, similarly, you know, she's sort of messy, she's sort of complicated, she's not perfect, she's not a perfect hero, she's not a perfect victim either. So I think, yeah, it was sort of like this double standard that was interesting to me, because, you know, a lot of the pushback was being perpetuated by people who I thought might themselves have been, you know, targets or victims of such a double standard. So it was just like deeply ironic and confusing. But also I think it forced me to kind of reflect on, you know, why this was happening or what the climate around this book was that might have, you know, allowed this to happen. And I think, you know, there's sort of like two pet theories I have. One is that, you know, increasingly it feels like capitalism forces us to express our political agency through the things we consume. So like the books we read or the movies we watch or the things we buy. And so it feels like those things then have to be extensions of who we are morally or who we want to be morally. And so I think people are asking this book or other books even increasingly to just sort of like tell them how to be or somehow, you know, be like a moral standard bearer, which I think is not the role of fiction. And then I also just thought, you know what? It's a hard time to be alive. Like, I think we all collectively have not fully recovered from the pandemic or even like started to acknowledge that it's something that we need to recover from, I think. And so that combined with, you know, a lot of other challenges that we're facing in the modern economy, like income inequality and in America in particular, like healthcare is sort of non-existent, like there's no social safety net, et cetera. So I think people are just struggling. And I can imagine that if you are a troll or inclined to troll, that like sometimes maybe it feels good to vent. And so maybe I don't know, I was sort of like allowing for the possibility that this was just one way that people could get something off their chest. But I think at the same time, not to diminish the fact that this book, because, you know, it deals with very charged political concepts, is like very triggering to people. So I get that. So I think it's like a conflation of all these things, you know.
I feel like I have to say, like, really pointedly for listeners, like, it is all these things around race and political worldview. It's also very funny, and it is really this kind of romantic comedy. Maybe that's the wrong description, but it is a love story, and I feel like I read it in 2 days. I could see it on beach read lists as well while it grapples with these complex things.
Yeah, I think I definitely wanted it to be all of those things. So it's a bit maybe different in that way. But I don't know what version of the book you've read, but currently, like, the final version has two epigraphs. One is from the rom-com from, I think, the 90s, Clueless, starring Alicia Silverstone, and the other is from Toni Morrison. So I feel like that is kind of how I try to set or manage expectations, because, yeah, there's a rom-com on the one hand, but there's also sort of like this incendiary critique of racism and capitalism and
that actually
current political discourse.
Perfectly, those two things.
Like, I think so.
Just continuing briefly in this vein of humour, McSweeney's is a brilliant humour website. You published a series of works on McSweeney's entitled Mostly Uninformative Infographs. I actually thought these were really recent, mainly I think because I'd seen one about Taylor Swift, and Taylor Swift is topical at the moment, people attempting to buy tickets. They're a little bit older than what I had envisaged, but I want to talk about them anyway. An example of one might be things rich people in cities complain about, and it's a graph about whether brunch is worth the wait, and it relates wait times to the quality of Bloody Marys that are served. You did quite a few of these. I know you have a background in data and statistics. When you're creating a funny infograph, what's the starting point and where's the trial and error?
Yeah, it's funny you should ask because I've never thought about this in relation to my novel writing, but it's sort of the same process. Like, I'll think of sort of high level, something that I want to say something about. So usually it's something in the zeitgeist. Sorry, I just said something a lot. But like Taylor Swift, like hot topic, actually super evergreen. It's funny, right? Because I wrote those years ago and she's still sort of top of the news. But yeah, I think about something I want to talk about. And then I think about sort of underneath that topic, what's interesting. So like Taylor Swift, you might be like, yeah, getting tickets to her concert is just a mayhem. So I come up with sort of like all the things that are interesting about the thing. And then that's sort of on the left-hand side. And then on the right-hand side, I think about different visualizations that are exciting to me at the time. So, you know, I might be interested in like interactive charts or, you know, dot plots or whatever it is. And then I sort of like mix and match and say, oh, how could I talk about, you know, buying tickets to a concert in the form of a dot plot? And yeah, I sort of iterate. Sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes it works right away. But sometimes if you're stuck, I can, you know, think of sort of like breaking it down and be like, okay, so there's two numbers. Like, what's a good graph for expressing two numbers? Or there's two opposite ideas. Like, what's a good graph for showing two opposite ideas? And so in that way, that was when I was working at Google as a data scientist. It was almost like doing like personal projects on the company dime, because I was like, no, I'm just researching charts here. Like, this is what you're paying me to do, you know?
That's great. Cecilia, we have a lot of listeners to the show that are writers. Can you tell us what is either the best or the worst writing advice you've ever received?
Yeah, I think I feel like I have to caveat. So this is not the best advice, but it's sort of like very good advice before I tell you the best advice. It's helpful to caveat every single piece of advice because there's a lot of advice that works for a lot of people, but it's all so idiosyncratic. And it took me, you know, writing a novel to kind of figure that out. Like, what works for me just may or may not work for anyone else. That said, the best advice that I've gotten and that I continue to give, and that seems to resonate with a lot of people, is that you have to finish. So whatever you're doing, it has to be done. It doesn't have to be good. It doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be finished. And I think when I say this, it really hits at home. Everyone's read a really bad book or a really mediocre book or like just a really messy book, but no one has ever published, well, with few exceptions, an unfinished manuscript. And so that's kind of like, I think, the ultimate goal, to just get to the end and then figure out what to do when you get there.
That's a great point. Final question. Can you recommend a book by a debut author? It can be from any year, any genre, published in any place.
Yeah, so I'm actually going to recommend a book that is on its way to publication. I think it's going to come out in August, so just a couple months from today, which is July 13th. Shark Heart by Emily Habeck. The premise is this young-ish couple, very in love, newlyweds, happily married, get a diagnosis that the husband is going to turn into a great white shark within the next 6 months. And the book totally lives up to the premise. Yeah, and I'm not usually into, you know, sort of speculative fiction or books about great white sharks, but this book is so gorgeous. It's about grief and loneliness and love and family, but it's like so fresh. And also I think has a lot to say about animals and humans and what it means to be a human animal and nature. It's just really smart. And I read it in literally one sitting. I think people say that a lot, but I picked it up and I did not put it down.
Well, that's the best.
Until I was finished.
Oh, very excited. Shark Heart. So it's on the list. Thank you, Cecilia, for being on the First Time Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. This is fantastic.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.